K-Set stood sentinel. The air hockey table was littered with little snips of colored electrical wire. "What's this?" she said, picking up a piece of it. "This wasn't here before." He shrugged. "Maybe Harold's building a better mousetrap." There was a box under the table, and he fished it out. The cover said, "Deluxe Realistic Walkie-Talkie Set, Batteries Not Included." Larry opened the box, but the heft of it had already told him it was empty. "Building walkie-talkies instead of mousetraps," Fran said. "No, this wasn't a kit. You buy this kind ready to go. Maybe he was modifying them somehow. It sounds like Harold. Remember how Stu bitched about the walkie-talkie reception when he and Harold and Ralph were out hunting for Mother Abigail?" She nodded, but there was still something about those snips of wire that bothered her. Larry dropped the box back onto the floor and made what he would later think of as the most wildly erroneous statement of his entire life. "It doesn't matter," he said. "Let's go." They went up the stairs, but this time the door at the top was locked. She looked at him, and Larry shrugged. "We've come this far, right?" Fran nodded. Larry bumped his shoulder against the door a few times to get the feel of the bolt on the other side, and then rammed it hard. There was a snapping metal sound, a clunk, and the door swung open. Larry bent and picked up a bolt assembly from the linoleum kitchen floor. "I can put this back on and he'll never know the difference. That is, if there's a screwdriver handy." "Why bother? He's going to see the broken window." "That's true, but if the bolt's back on the door, he'll..." "What are you smiling about?" "Put the bolt back on, by all means. But how are you going to draw it from the cellar side of the door?" He thought about it and said, "Geez, I hate a smart-ass woman worse than anything." He tossed the bolt onto the formica kitchen counter. "Let's go look under that hearthstone." They went into the shadowy living room, and Fran felt anxiety start to creep up. Last time, Nadine hadn't had a key. This time, if she came back, she would. And if she did come back, they would be caught red-handed. It would be a bitter joke if Stu's first job as marshal turned out to be arresting his own woman for breaking and entering. "That's it, isn't it?" Larry asked, pointing.
"Yes, be as quick as you can."
"There's a good chance he's moved it anyway." And Harold had. It was Nadine who had replaced it under the loose hearthstone. Larry and Fran knew nothing of that, only that when Larry pulled the loose hearthstone aside, the book lay there in the hollow beneath, the word ledger gleaming mellowly up at them in gold-filled letters. They both stared at it. The room seemed suddenly hotter, stuffier, darker. "Well," Larry said, "are we going to admire it or read it?"
"You," Fran said, "I don't even want to touch it."
Larry picked it out of the hole and automatically wiped the white stone dust from the cover. He began to flip through it at random. The writing had been done with a felt-tipped marker of the sort that had been marketed under the pugnacious brand name Hardhead. It had allowed Harold to write in a tiny, perfect script, the handwriting of an intensely conscientious man, perhaps a driven man. There were no paragraph breaks. There was only an eyelash of a margin to the right and left, but that margin was constant, so straight that it might have been drawn with a ruler. "It'd take me 3 days to read all this," Larry said, and went on flipping toward the front of the book.
"Hold it," Fran said, and reached over his arm to turn back a couple of pages.
Here the steady flow of words was broken by a boldly boxed-off area. What had been enclosed seemed to be some sort of motto. "To follow one's star is to concede the power of some greater force, some providence. Yet is it still not possible that the act of following itself is the taproot of even greater power? Your God, your devil, owns the keys to the lighthouse. I have grappled with that so long and hard in these last 2 months, but to each of us he has given the responsibility of navigation. Harold Emery Lauder."
"Sorry," Harold said, "it's by me. You get it?"
Fran shook her head slowly.
"I guess it's Harold's way of saying following can be as honorable as leading. But as a motto, I don't think it's going to put waste not, want not out of business."
Larry continued to flip toward the front of the book,
coming upon another four or five of the boxed maxims, all of them attributed to Harold in capital letters.
"Whew," Larry said. "Look at this one, Franny."
"It is said that the two great human sins are pride and hate. Are they? I elect to think of them as the two great virtues. To give away pride and hate is to say you will change for the good of the world. To vent them is more noble. That is to say the world must change for the good of you. I am on a great adventure. Harold Emery Lauder."
"That's the work of a profoundly disturbed mind," Fran said. She felt cold.
"It's the kind of thinking that got us into this mess to start with," Larry agreed. He flipped rapidly to the start of the book. "Time's wasting. Let's see what we can make of this."
Neither of them knew exactly what to expect. They had read nothing of the ledger except the boxed mottos and an occasional phrase or two which, mostly owing to Harold's convoluted style, the compound complex sentence seemed to have been invented with Harold Lauder in mind, meant little or nothing. What they saw at the ledger's beginning was therefore a complete shock. The diary began at the top of the first facing page. It was neatly marked with a one in a circle. There was an indent here, the only indent in the whole book as far as Franny could tell, excepting those which began each boxed motto. They read that first sentence holding the ledger between them like children at a choir practice, and Fran said, "Oh," in a small strangled voice and stepped away, her hand pressed lightly to her mouth.
"Fran, we have to take the book," Larry said.
"Yes."
"And show it to Stu. I don't know if Leo's right about them being on the dark man's side, but at the very least Harold is dangerously disturbed. You can see that."
"Yes,"
she said again. She felt faint, weak. So this was how the matter of the diaries ended. It was as if she had known, as if she had known it all from the moment she saw that big smudged thumbprint, and she had to keep telling herself not to faint, not to faint. "Fran? Franny, are you all right?"
Larry's voice, from far away. The first sentence in Harold's ledger.
"My great pleasure this delightful post-apocalypse summer will be to kill Mr. Stuart Dog Cock Redman, and just maybe I will kill her, too."
"Ralph? Ralph Brentner, you home? Hoo-hoo! Anybody home?"
She stood on the steps, looking at the house. No motorcycles in the yard, only a couple of bikes parked around to one side. Ralph would have heard her, but there was the mute to think about. The deaf mute. You could holler until you were blue, and he wouldn't answer, and still he might be there. Shifting her shopping bag from one arm to the other, Nadine tried the door and found it unlocked. She stepped inside out of the fine mist which was falling. She was in a small foyer. Four steps went up to the kitchen, and a flight of them went down to the basement area, where Harold said Andros had his apartment. Putting her most pleasant expression on her face, Nadine went downstairs, fixing her excuse in her mind if he should be there.
"I came right in because I didn't think you'd know if I was knocking. Some of us wanted to know if there's going to be a late shift wrapping those two motors that blew. Did Brad say anything to you?"
There were only two rooms down here. One of them was a bedroom as simple as a monk's cell. The other was a study. There was a desk, a big chair, a wastebasket, a bookcase. The top of the desk was littered with scraps of paper, and she looked through them idly. Most of them made little sense to her. She guessed they were Nick's side of some conversation.
"I guess so, but shouldn't we ask him if it can be done in some simpler way?" one of them read.
Others seemed to be memos to himself, jottings, thoughts. A few of them reminded her of the boxes in Harold's ledger, what he called his guideposts to a better life, with a sarcastic smile. One read, "Talk to Glenn about trade. Do any of us know how trade starts? Scarcity of goods, isn't it? Or a modified corner on some market? Skills. That may be a key word. What if Brad Kitchener decides to sell instead of giving away? Or the dock? What would we pay with? Another, "Community protection is a two-way street." Another, "Every time we talk about the law, I spend the night having nightmares about Shoyo, watching them die, watching Childress throw his supper around the cell. The law. The law. What do we do about the goddamned law? Capital punishment. Now there's a smiley thought. When Brad gets the power on, how long before someone asks him to rig up an electric chair? She turned away from the scraps, reluctantly. It was fascinating to look through papers left by a man who could think wholly only by writing. One of her college profs had been fond of saying that the thought process can never be complete without articulation. But her purpose down here was already completed. Nick was not here. No one was here. To linger over long would be to press her luck unnecessarily. She went back upstairs. Harold had told her they would probably meet in the living room. It was a huge room, carpeted with a thick wine-colored shag rug, dominated by a freestanding fireplace that went up through the roof in a column of rock. The entire west wall was glass, giving on a magnificent view of the Flatirons. It made her feel as exposed as a bug on a wall. She knew that the outer surface of the thermoplex was iodized, so that anyone outside would only see a mirror-like reflection, but the psychological feeling was still one of utter exposure. She wanted to finish quickly. On the southern side of the room, she found what she was looking for, a deep closet that Ralph hadn't cleaned out. Coats hung far back inside, and in the rear corner there was a tangle of boots and mittens and winter woolens about 3 feet deep. Working quickly, she took the groceries out of her shopping bag. They were camouflage, and there was only a single layer of them. Beneath the cans of tomato paste and sardines was the hush puppy's shoebox with the dynamite and the walkie-talkie inside. "If I put it in a closet, will it still work?" she had asked. "Won't the extra wall muffle the blast?" "Nadine," Harold had responded. "If that device works, and I have no reason whatever to believe it won't, it will take the house and most of the surrounding hillside. Put it anywhere you think it will be unobserved until their meeting. A closet will be fine. The extra wall will blow out and become shrapnel. I trust your judgment, dear. It's going to be just like the old fairy tale about the tailor and the flies. 7 at a blow. Only in this case we're dealing with a bunch of political cockroaches." Nadine pushed aside boots and scarves, made a hole, and slipped the shoebox into it. She covered it over again and then worked her way out of the closet. There, done, for better or worse. She left the house quickly, not looking back, trying to ignore the voice that wouldn't stay dead. The voice that was now telling her to go back in there and pull the wires that ran between the blasting caps and the walkie-talkie, telling her to give this up before it drove her mad. Because wasn't that what was really lying somewhere up ahead, now maybe less than 2 weeks ahead? Wasn't madness the final logical conclusion? She slipped the bag of groceries into the Vespa's carrier and kicked the machine into life. And all the time she was driving away, that voice went on. "You're not going to leave that there, are you? You're not going to leave that bomb in there, are you? In a world where so many have died..." She leaned into a turn, barely able to see where she was going. Tears had begun to blur her eyes. "The one great sin is to take a human life. 7 lives here. No more than that, because the committee was going to hear reports from the heads of several subcommittees." She stopped at the corner of Baseline and Broadway, thinking she would turn around and go back. She was shuddering all over. And later she would never be able to explain to Harold precisely what had happened. In truth, she never even tried. It was a foretaste of the horrors to come. She felt a blackness creeping over her vision. It came like a dark curtain slowly drawn, flipping and flapping in a mild breeze. Every now and then the breeze would gust, the curtain would flap more vigorously, and she would see a bit of daylight under its hem, a little bit of this deserted intersection. But the curtain came over her vision in steady blackout drifts, and soon she was lost in it. She was blind, she was deaf, she was without the sense of touch. The thinking creature, the Nadine ego, drifted in a warm black cocoon like seawater, like amniotic fluid. And she felt him creep into her. A shriek built up within her, but she had no mouth with which to scream. Penetration. Entropy. She didn't know what those words meant, put together like that. She only knew that they were right. It was like nothing she had ever felt before. Later, metaphors occurred to her to describe it, and she rejected them, one by one. You're swimming, and suddenly, in the midst of the warm water, you're treading water in a pocket of deep, numbing cold. You've been given Novocaine, and the dentist pulls a tooth. It comes out with a painless tug. You spit blood into the white enamel basin. There's a hole in you. You've been gouged. You can slip your tongue into the hole where part of you was living a second ago. You stare at your face in the mirror. You stare at it for a long time. 5 minutes, 10, 15. No fair blinking. You watch with an intellectual sort of horror as your face changes, like the face of Lon Chaney Jr. in a werewolf epic. You become a stranger to yourself, an olive-skinned doppelganger, a psychotic vampira with pale skin and fish-slit eyes. It was really none of those things, but there was a taste trace of all of them. The dark man entered her, and he was cold. When Nadine opened her eyes, her first thought was that she was in hell. Hell was whiteness, the thesis to the dark man's antithesis. She saw white, ivory, bleached out nothingness. White, white, white. It was white hell, and it was everywhere. She stared at the whiteness. It was impossible to stare into it. Fascinated, agonized, for minutes before she realized she could feel the fork of the Vespa between her thighs and that there was another color, green, at the periphery of her vision. With a jerk, she pulled her eyes out of their blank, locked stare. She gazed around herself. Her mouth was slack, trembling, the eyes themselves dazed and horror-drugged. The dark man had been in her. Flag had been in her. And when he had come, he had driven her away from the windows of her five senses, her loopholes on reality. He had driven her as a man might drive a car or a truck. And he had brought her... where? She glanced toward the white and saw it was a huge blank drive-in movie screen against a background of white late-afternoon rainy sky. Turning around, she saw the snack bar. It was painted a garish flesh-toned pink. Written across the front was, "Welcome to the Holiday Twin. Enjoy entertainment under the stars tonight." The darkness had come on her at the intersection of Baseline and Broadway. Now she was far out on 28th Street, almost over the town line to Longmont, wasn't it? There was a taste of him in her still, far back in her mind, like cold slime on a floor. She was surrounded by poles, steel poles like sentries, each of them 5 feet high, each bearing a matched set of drive-in speakers. There was gravel underfoot, but grass and dandelions were growing up through it. She guessed the Holiday Twin hadn't been doing much business since the middle of June or so. You could say that it had been kind of a dead summer for the entertainment biz. "Why am I here?" she whispered. It was only talking aloud, talking to herself. She expected no answer, so when she was answered, a shriek of terror pealed from her throat. All the speakers fell off the speaker poles at once and onto the weed-strewn gravel. The sound they made was a huge, amplified chunk, the sound of a dead body striking gravel. "Nadine!" the speakers blared, and it was his voice, and how she shrieked then! Her hands flew to her head, her palms clapped themselves over her ears, but it was all the speakers at once, and there was no hiding from that giant voice, which was full of fearful hilarity and dreadful comic lust. "Nadine, Nadine, oh, how I love to love Nadine, my pet, my pretty—" "Stop it!" she shrieked back, straining her vocal cords with the force of her cry, and still her voice was so small compared with that giant's bellow. And yet for a moment the voice did stop. There was silence. The fallen speakers looked up at her from the gravel like the rugose eyes of giant insects. Nadine's hands slowly came down from her ears. "You've gone insane," she comforted herself. "That's all it is, the strain of waiting, and Harold's games. Finally planting the explosive. All of it has finally driven you over the edge, dear, and you've gone crazy. It's probably better this way." But she hadn't gone crazy, and she knew it.
This was far worse than being crazy. As if to prove this, the speakers now boomed out in the stern yet almost prissy voice of a principal reprimanding the student body over the high school intercom for some prank they had all played together.
"Nadine, they know."
"They know," she parroted. She wasn't sure who they were or what they knew, but she was quite sure it was inevitable.
"You've been stupid. God may love stupidity, I do not."
The words crackled and rolled away into the late afternoon. Her clothes clung soddenly to her skin, her hair lay lankly against her pallid cheeks, and she began to shiver.
"Stupid," she thought. "Stupid, stupid. I know what that word means. I think it means death."
"They know everything, except the shoebox, the dynamite."
Speakers. Speakers everywhere, staring up at her from the white gravel, peeking at her from clusters of dandelions closed against the rain.
"Go to Sunrise Amphitheater. Stay there. Until tomorrow night. Until they meet. And then you and Harold may come. Come to me."
Now Nadine began to feel a simple, shining gratitude. They had been stupid, but they had also been granted a second chance. They were important enough to have warranted intervention. And soon, very soon, she would be with him. And then she would go crazy, she was quite sure of it, and all this would cease to matter.
"Sunrise Amphitheater may be too far," she said.
Her vocal cords had been hurt somehow. She could only croak.
"It may be too far for the..."
"For the what?" she pondered.
Oh, yes, right. "For the walkie-talkie. The signal."
No answer. The speakers lay on the gravel, staring at her, hundreds of them. She pushed the Vespa's starter, and the little engine coughed to life. The echo made her wince. It sounded like rifle fire. She wanted to get out of this awful place, away from those staring speakers. Had to get out. She overbalanced the motor scooter going around the concession stand. She might have held it if she'd been on a paved surface, but the Vespa's rear wheel skidded out from under her in the loose gravel, and she fell with a thump, biting her lip bloody and cutting her cheek. She got up, her eyes wide and skittish, and drove on. She was trembling all over. Now she was in the alley the cars drove through to get into the drive-in, and the ticket stand, looking like a small toll booth, was just ahead of her. She was going to get out. She was going to get away. Her mouth softened in gratitude. Behind her, hundreds of speakers blared into life all at once, and now the voice was singing, in a horrid, tuneless singing.
"I'll be seeing you. In all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through."
Nadine screamed in her newly cracked voice. Huge, monstrous laughter came then, a dark and sterile cackling which seemed to fill the earth.
"Do well, Nadine," the voice boomed. "Do well, my fancy, my dear one."
Then she gained the road and fled back toward Boulder at the Vespa's top speed, leaving the disembodied voice and staring speakers behind, but carrying them with her in her heart, for then, for always. She was waiting for Harold around the corner from the bus station. When he saw her, his face froze and drained of color.
"Nadine," he whispered.
The lunch bucket dropped from his hand and clacked on the pavement.
"Harold," she said, "they know. We've got to—"
"Your hair, Nadine. Oh, my God, your hair." His face seemed to be all eyes.
"Listen to me."
He seemed to gain some of himself back.
"All right. What?"
"They went up to your house and found your book. They took it away." Emotions at war on Harold's face. Anger, horror, shame. Little by little they drained away, and then, like some terrible corpse coming up from deep water, a frozen grin resurfaced on Harold's face.
"Who? Who did that?" I don't know all of it, and it doesn't matter anyway. Fran Goldsmith was one of them, I'm sure of that. Maybe Bateman or Underwood, I don't know, but they'll come for you, Harold.
How do you know?
He grabbed her roughly by the shoulders, remembering that she had put the ledger back under the hearthstone. He shook her like a rag doll, but Nadine faced him without fear. She had been face to face with more terrible things than Harold Lauder on this long, long day.
You bitch! How do you know?
He told me. Harold's hands dropped away.
Flag?
A whisper.
He told you? He spoke to you? And it did that?
Harold's grin was ghastly, the grin of the Reaper on horseback.
What are you talking about?
They were standing next to an appliance store. Taking her by the shoulders again, Harold turned her to face the glass. Nadine looked at her reflection for a long time. Her hair had gone white, entirely white. There was not a single black strand left.
Oh, how I love to love Nadine.
Come on, she said, we have to leave town.
Now?
After dark. We'll hide until then and pick up what camping gear we need on the way out.
West?
Not yet. Not until tomorrow night.
Maybe I don't want to anymore,
Harold whispered. He was still looking at her hair. She put his hand on it.
Too late, Harold, she said.
Chapter 58 Fran and Larry sat at the kitchen table of Stu and Fran's place, sipping coffee. Downstairs, Leo was stretching out on his guitar, one that Larry had helped him pick out at Earthly Sounds. It was a nice $600 Gibson with a hand-rubbed cherry finish. As an afterthought, he had gotten the boy a battery-powered phonograph and about a dozen folk blues albums. Now Lucy was with him, and a startlingly good imitation of Dave Van Ronk's Backwater Blues drifted up to them. Well, it rained 5 days, and the sky turned black as night. There's trouble taking place on the bayou tonight. Through the arch that gave on the living room, Fran and Larry could see Stu sitting in his favorite easy chair, Harold's ledger open on his lap. He had been sitting that way since 4 in the afternoon. It was now 9, and full dark. He had refused supper. As Franny watched him, he turned another page. Down below, Leo finished Backwater Blues, and there was a pause.
He plays well, doesn't he? Fran said.
Better than I do or ever will, Larry said. He sipped his coffee. From below there suddenly came a familiar chop, a swift running down the frets to a not-quite-standard blues regression that made Larry's coffee cup pause. And then Leo's voice, low and insinuating, adding the vocal to the slow driving beat. Hey, baby, I come down here tonight, and I didn't come to get in no fight. I just want you to say if you can. Tell me once, and I'll understand. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Baby, can you dig your man? Larry spilled his coffee. Whoops, Fran said, and got up to get a dishcloth. I'll do it, he said. Jiggled when I should have joggled, I guess. No, sit still. She got the dishcloth and wiped up the stain quickly. I remember that one. It was big just before the flu. He must have picked up the single downtown.
I guess so.
What was that guy's name, the guy that did it?
I can't remember, Larry said. Pop music came and went so fast.
Yes, but it was something familiar, she said, wringing the dishcloth out at the sink. It's funny how you get something like that on the tip of your tongue, isn't it?
Yeah, Larry said.
Stu closed the ledger with a soft snap, and Larry was relieved to see her look at him as he came into the kitchen. Her eyes went first to the gun on his hip. He had been wearing it since his election as marshal, and he made a lot of jokes about shooting himself in the foot. Fran didn't think the jokes were all that funny. Well? Larry asked. Stu's face was deeply troubled. He put the ledger on the table and sat down. Fran started to get him a cup of coffee, and he shook his head and put a hand on her forearm. No thanks, honey. He looked at Larry in an absent, distracted sort of way. I read it all, and now I've got a damn headache. Not used to reading so much. Last book I just sat down and read all the way through like that was this rabbit story, Watership Down. I got it for a nephew of mine and just started to read it.
He trailed off for a moment, thinking.
I read that one, Larry said. Great book.
There was this one bunch of rabbits, Stu said, and they had it solved. They were big and well-fed, and they always lived in one place. There was something wrong there, but none of the rabbits knew what it was. Seemed like they didn't want to know. Only see, there was this farmer.
Larry said, he left the warren alone so he could take a rabbit for the stew pot whenever he wanted one. Or maybe he sold them. Either way, he had his own little rabbit farm.
Yeah, and there was this one rabbit, Silverweed, and he made up poems about the shining wire, the snare the farmer caught the rabbits in, I guess. The snare the farmer used to catch them and strangle them. Silverweed made up poems about that.
He shook his head in slow, tired incredulity.
And that's what Harold reminds me of. Silverweed the rabbit.
Harold's ill, Fran said.
Yeah. Stu lit a cigarette.
And dangerous.
What should we do, arrest him?
Stu tapped the ledger.
He and the cross woman are planning to do something so they'll be made to feel welcome when they go west, but this book doesn't say what.
It mentions a lot of people he's not too crazy about, Larry said.
Are we going to arrest him? Fran asked again.
I just don't know. I want to talk it over with the rest of the committee first. What's on for tomorrow night, Larry?
Well, the meeting's going to be in two halves, public business and then private business. Brad wants to talk about his turning off crew. Al Bundell wants to present a preliminary report from the law committee. Let's see. George Richardson on clinic hours at Dakota Ridge, then Chad Norris. After that, they leave and it's just us.
If we get Al Bundell to stay after and fill him in on this Harold business, can we be sure he'll keep his lip zipped?
I'm sure we can, Fran said.
Stu said fretfully, I wish the judge was here. I cottoned to that man.
They were quiet for a moment, thinking about the judge, wondering where he might be tonight. From below came the sound of Leo playing Sister Kate, like Tom Rush.
But if it's got to be Al, it's got to be. I only see two choices anyway. We have to take the pair of them out of circulation. But I don't want to put them in jail, goddammit.
What does that leave? Larry asked.
It was Fran who answered.
Exile.
Larry turned to her. Stu was nodding slowly, looking at his cigarette.
Just drive him out? Larry asked.
Him and her both, Stu said.
But will Flag take them like that? Franny asked.
Stu looked up at her then. Honey, that ain't our problem.
She nodded and thought, Oh, Harold, I didn't want it to come out like this. Never in a million years did I want it to come out this way.
Any idea what they might be planning? Stu asked.
Larry shrugged.
You'd have to get the whole committee's thoughts on that, Stu, but I can think of some things.
Such as?
The power plant, sabotage, an assassination attempt on you and Franny. Those are just the first two things that occur to me.
Fran looked pale and dismayed.
Larry went on. Although he doesn't come right out and say it, I think he went hunting for Mother Abigail with you and Ralph that time in hopes of getting you alone and killing you.
Stu said he had his chance.
Maybe he chickened.
Stop it, can't you? Fran asked Dolly. Please.
Stu got up and went back into the living room. There was a CB in there hooked up to a die-hard battery. After some tinkering, he got Brad Kitchener.
Brad, you dog. Stu Redman. Listen, can you round up some guys to stand watch at the power station tonight?
Sure,
Brad's voice came. But what in God's name for?
Well, this is kind of delicate, Bradley. I heard one way and another that somebody might try doing some mischief up there.
Brad's reply was blue with profanity. Stu nodded at the mic, smiling a little.
I know how you feel. This is just for tonight and maybe tomorrow night, so far as I know. Then I guess things will be ironed out.
Brad told him he could muster 12 men from the power committee without going two blocks,
and any one of them would be happy to geld any would-be mischief-maker.
"This something Rich Moffat's up to?"
"No, it ain't Rich. Listen, I'll be talking to you, okay?"
"Fine, Stu. I'll have them on watch."
Stu turned off the CB and walked back to the kitchen. "People let you be just as secret as you want to be. It scares me, you know. The old bald-headed sociologist is right. We could set ourselves up like kings here if we wanted to."
Fran put her hand over his. "I want you to promise me something, both of you. Promise me we'll settle this once and for all at the meeting tomorrow night. I just want it to be over."
Larry was nodding.
"Exile. Yeah, it never crossed my mind, but it might be the best solution. Well, I'm going to collect Lucy and Leo and get home."
"I'll see you tomorrow," Stu said.
"Yeah."
He went out. In the hour before dawn on September 2nd, Harold stood on the edge of Sunrise Amphitheater, looking down. The town was in a ditch of blackness. Nadine slept behind him in the small two-man tent they had picked up along with a few other camping supplies as they crept out of town.
"We'll come back, though, driving chariots."
But in his secret heart, Harold doubted that. The darkness was upon him in more ways than one. The vile bastards had stolen everything from him. Franny, his self-respect, then his ledger, now his hope. He felt that he was going down. The wind was strong, rippling his hair, making the tight canvas of the tent snap back and forth with a steady machine gun popping sound. Behind him, Nadine moaned in her sleep. It was a scary sound. Harold thought she was as lost as he was, maybe worse. The sounds she made in her sleep were not the sounds of a person having happy dreams.
"But I can keep sane. I can do that. If I can go down to whatever's waiting for me with my mind intact, that will be something. Yes, something."
He wondered if they were down there now, Stu and his friends, surrounding his little house, if they were waiting for him to come home so they could arrest him and throw him in the cooler. He would go down in the history books, if any of those sorry slobs were left to write them, that was, as the Free Zone's first jailbird. Welcome to hard times.
"Hawk caged, Wuxtry, Wuxtry, read all about it."
Well, they could wait a long time. He was on his adventure, and he remembered all too clearly Nadine putting his hand on her white hair and saying, "Too late, Harold." How like a corpse's her eyes had been.
"All right," Harold whispered. "We're going through with it."
Around and above him, the dark September wind drummed through the trees. The Free Zone committee meeting was wrapped to order some 14 hours later in the living room of the house Ralph Brentner and Nick Andros shared. Stu was sitting in an easy chair, tapping an end table with the rim of his beer can.
"Okay, folks, we better get started here."
Glenn sat with Larry on the curving lip of the freestanding fireplace, their backs to the modest fire Ralph had kindled there. Nick, Susan Stern, and Ralph himself sat on the couch. Nick held the inevitable pen and pad of notepaper. Brad Kitchener was standing just inside the doorway with a can of Coors in his hand, talking to Al Bundell, who was working a scotch and soda. George Richardson and Chad Norris were sitting by the large window wall, watching the sunset over the Flatirons. Franny was sitting with her back propped comfortably against the door of the closet where Nadine had planted the bomb. Her pack, with Harold's ledger inside it, was between her folded legs.
"Order, I say, order," Stu said, rapping harder. "That tape recorder working, Baldy?"
"It's fine," Glenn said.
"I see your mouth is in good working order, too, East Texas."
"I oil her a little, and she do just fine," Stu said, smiling.
He glanced around at the 11 people spotted around the big combination living room-dining room area.
"All right, we've got a right smart of business, but first I'd like to thank Ralph for providing the roof over our heads and the booze and the crackers."
He's getting really good at it, Franny thought.
She tried to judge just how much Stu had changed since the day she and Harold had met him, and couldn't do it. You get too subjective about the behavior of the people you're close to, she decided.
but she knew that when she had first met him, Stu would have been stricken at the thought of having to chair a meeting of almost a dozen people, and he probably would have jumped straight up to heaven at the thought of chairing a mass free zone meeting of over 1,000 people. She was now watching a Stu that never would have been without the plague. "It's released you, my darling," she thought. "I can cry for the others and still be so proud of you and love you so much." She shifted a little, propping her back more firmly against the closet door. "We'll have our guests speak first," Stu said, "and after that we'll have a short closed meeting. Any objections to that?" There were none. "Okay," Stu said. "I'll turn the floor over to Brad Kitchener, and you folks want to listen close because he's the guy that's going to put the rocks back in your bourbon in about 3 days." This generated a hearty round of spontaneous applause. Blushing furiously, tugging at his tie, Brad walked to the center of the room. He came very close to tripping over a hassock on his way. "I'm real happy to be here," Brad began in a trembling monotone. He looked as if he would have been happier anywhere else, even at the South Pole, addressing a penguin convention. He paused, examining his notes, and then brightened. "The power," he exclaimed, with the air of a man making a great discovery. "The power is almost on, right." He fumbled with his notes some more and then went on. "We had two of the generators going yesterday, and as you know, one of them overloaded and blew its cookies, so to speak. What I mean is that it overloaded, rather. Well, you know what I mean." A chuckle ran through them, and it seemed to put Brad a little more at ease. "That happened because when the plague hit, a lot of stuff got left on, and we didn't have the rest of the generators on to take the overload. We can take care of the overload danger by turning on the rest of the generators. Even 3 or 4 would have absorbed the load easily. But that isn't going to solve the fire danger, so we've got to get everything shut off that we can. Stove burners, electric blankets, all that stuff. In fact, I was thinking like this. The quickest way might be to go into every house where no one lives and just pull all the fuses or turn off the main breaker switches, see? Now, when we get ready to turn on, I think we ought to take some elementary fire precautions. I went to the liberty of checking out the fire station in East Boulder, and..." The fire snapped comfortably. "It's going to be all right," Fran thought. "Harold and Nadine have taken off without any prompting, and maybe that's best. It solves the problem, and Stu is safe from them. Poor Harold. I felt sorry for you, but in the end I felt more fear than pity. The pity is still there, and I'm afraid of what may happen to you, but I'm glad your house is empty, and you and Nadine have gone. I'm glad you've left us in peace." Harold sat atop a graffiti-inlaid picnic table like something out of a lunatic's Zen handbook. His legs were crossed. His eyes were far, hazy, contemplative. He had gone to that cold and alien place where Nadine could not follow, and she was frightened. In his hands he held the twin of the walkie-talkie in the shoebox. The mountains fell away in front of them in breathtaking ledges and pine-choked ravines. Miles to the east, maybe 10, maybe 40, the land smoothed into the American Midwest and marched away to the dim blue horizon. Night had already come over that part of the world. Behind them, the sun had just disappeared behind the mountains, leaving them outlined in gold that would flake and fade. "When?" Nadine asked. She was horribly keyed up, and she had to go to the bathroom badly. "Pretty soon," Harold said. His grin had become a mellow smile. It was an expression she could not place right away, because she had never seen it on Harold's face before. It took her a few minutes to place it. Harold looked happy. The committee voted 7-0 to empower Brad to round up 20 men and women for his turning-off crew. Ralph Brentner had agreed to fill up 2 of the fire department's old tanker trucks at Boulder Reservoir and to have them at the power station when Brad turned on. Chad Norris was next. Speaking quietly, his hands stuffed into the pockets of his chino pants, he talked about the work the burial committee had done over the last 3 weeks. He told them they had buried an incredible 25,000 corpses, better than 8,000 a week,
and that he believed they were now over the bulge. "We've been either lucky or blessed," he said. "This mass exodus, that's all I know to call it, has done most of our work for us. In another town Boulder's size, it would have taken a year to get it done. We're expecting to inter another 20,000 plague victims by the 1st of October, and we'll probably keep stumbling over individual victims for a long time after that. But I wanted you to know that the job is getting done, and I don't think we have to worry too much about diseases breeding in the bodies of the unburied dead." Fran shifted her position so she could look out at the last of the day. The gold that had surrounded the peaks was already beginning to fade to a less spectacular lemon color. She felt a sudden wave of homesickness that was totally unexpected and almost sickening in its force. It was 5 minutes to 8. If she didn't go in the bushes, she was going to wet her pants. She went around a stand of scrub, lowered herself a little, and let go. When she came back, Harold was still sitting on the picnic table with the walkie-talkie clasped loosely in his hand. He had pulled up the antenna. "Harold," she said, "it's getting late. It's past 8 o'clock. He glanced at her indifferently. "They'll be there half the night, clapping each other on the back. When the time's right, I'll pull the pin, don't you worry." "When?" Harold's smile widened emptily. "Just as soon as it's dark." Fran stifled a yawn as Al Bundell stepped confidently up beside Stu. They were going to run late, and suddenly she wished she was back in the apartment, just the two of them. It wasn't just tiredness, not precisely that feeling of homesickness either. All of a sudden, she didn't want to be in this house. There was no reason for the feeling, but it was strong. She wanted to get out. In fact, she wanted them all to get out. "I've just lost my happy thoughts for the evening," she told herself. "Pregnant woman blues, that's all." "The law committee has had 4 meetings in the last week," Al was saying, "and I'll keep this as brief as possible. The system we've decided on is a kind of tribunal. Sitting members would be chosen by lottery, much the same way as young men were once selected for the draft." "Hiss, boo," Susan said, and there was some companionable laughter. Al smiled. "But I was going to add, I think service on such a tribunal would be a lot more palatable to those who were called upon to serve. The tribunal would consist of 3 adults, 18 and over, who would serve for 6 months. Their names would be picked out of a big drum containing the names of every adult in Boulder." Larry's hand waved. "Could they be excused for cause?" Frowning a trifle at this interruption, Al said, "I was just getting to that. There would have to be..." Fran shifted uneasily, and Sue Stern winked at her. Fran didn't wink back. She was frightened, and frightened of her own baseless fear, if such a thing were possible. Where had this stifling, claustrophobic feeling come from? She knew that what you were supposed to do with baseless feelings was to ignore them, at least in the old world. But what about Tom Collins' trance? What about Leo Rockway? "Get out of here," a voice inside suddenly cried. "Get them all out!" But it was so crazy. She shifted again and decided to say nothing. "A brief deposition from the person wanting to be excused, but I don't think..." "Someone's coming," Fran said suddenly, getting to her feet. There was a pause. They could all hear motorcycle engines revving toward them up baseline, coming fast. Horns were beeping, and suddenly, for Franny, the panic overflowed. "Listen," she said, "all of you..." Faces turning toward her, surprised, concerned. "Franny, are you—" Stu started toward her. She swallowed. It felt as if there was a heavy weight on her chest, stifling her. "We have to get out of here. Right now." It was 8:25. The last of the light had gone out of the sky. It was time. Harold sat up a little straighter and held the walkie-talkie to his mouth. His thumb rested lightly on the send button. He would depress it and blow them all to hell by saying, "What's that?" Nadine's hand on his arm, distracting him, pointing. Far below, snaking up baseline, there was a daisy chain of lights. In the great silence, they could hear the faint roar of a great many motorcycle engines.
Harold felt a thin thread of disquiet and threw it off.
"Leave me be," he said. "This is it."
Her hand fell from his shoulder. Her face was a white blur in the darkness. Harold pressed the send button. She never knew if it was the motorcycles or her own words that got them moving, but they didn't move fast enough. That would always be on her heart. They didn't move fast enough. Stu was first out the door, the snarl and echo of the motorcycles enormous. They came across the bridge that spanned the small dry wash below Ralph's house, headlights blazing. Instinctively, Stu's hand dropped to the butt of his gun. The screen door opened and he turned, thinking it would be Franny. It wasn't. It was Larry.
"What's up, Stu?"
"Don't know, but we better get them out."
Then the cycles were winding their way into the driveway and Stu relaxed a little. He could see Dick Volman, the Geringer kid, Teddy Wyzak, others he recognized. Now he could allow himself to recognize what his chief fear had been, that behind the blazing headlights and snarling motorcycle engines had been the spearhead of Flag's forces, that the war was about to start.
"Dick," Stu said, "what the hell?"
"Mother Abigail,"
Dick roared over the motors. More and more cycles filled the yard as the members of the committee crowded out of the house. It was a carnival of swinging headlights and merry-go-round shadows.
"What?"
Larry screamed. Behind him and Stu, Glenn, Ralph, and Chad Norris crowded out, forcing Larry and Stu to the foot of the steps.
"She's come back,"
Dick had to bellow to make himself heard over the cycles.
"Oh, she's in terrible shape. We need a doctor. Christ, we need a miracle."
George Richardson pushed through them.
"The old woman, where?"
"Get on, Doc," Dick shouted at him. "Don't ask questions. Just for Christ's sake, be quick."
Richardson mounted the cycle behind Dick Volman. Dick turned in a tight circle and began to weave his way back through the cluster of motorcycles. Stu's eyes met Larry's. Larry looked as bewildered as Stu felt, but there was a gathering cloud in Stu's head, and suddenly a terrible feeling of impending doom engulfed him.
"Nick, come on, come on,"
Fran cried, seizing his shoulder. Nick was standing in the middle of the living room, his face still, immobile. He couldn't talk, but suddenly he knew. He knew. It came from nowhere, from everywhere. There was something in the closet. He gave Franny a tremendous push.
"Nick, go,"
he waved at her. She went. He turned to the closet, pulled open the door, and began to rip madly at the tangle of things inside, praying God that he wasn't too late. Suddenly, Franny was next to Stu, her face pallid, her eyes huge. She clutched at him.
"Stu, Nick's still in there. Something...
"Franny, what are you talking about?"
"Death," she screamed at him. "I'm talking about death, and Nick is still in there."
He pulled aside a handful of scarves and mittens and felt something, a shoebox. He grabbed it, and as he did, like malign necromancy, Harold Lauder's voice spoke from inside it.
"What about Nick?" Stu shouted, grabbing her shoulders.
"We have to get him out, Stu. Something's going to happen, something awful."
Al Bundell shouted, "What the hell is going on, Stuart?"
"I don't know," Stu said.
"Stu, please, we have to get Nick out of there,"
Fran screamed. That was when the house blew up behind them. With the send button depressed, the background static disappeared and was replaced by a smooth, dark silence. Void, waiting for him to fill it. Harold sat cross-legged on the picnic table, summoning himself up. Then he raised his arm, and at the end of the arm, one finger pointed out of his knotted fist, and in that moment he was like Babe Ruth, old and almost washed up, pointing to the spot where he was going to hit the home run, pointing for all the hecklers and badmouths in Wrigley Field, shutting them up once and for all. Speaking firmly but not loudly into the walkie-talkie, he said, "This is Harold Emery Lauder speaking. I do this of my own free will." A blue-white spark greeted, "This is." A gout of flame shot up at Harold Emery Lauder speaking. A faint flat bang, like a cherry bomb stuffed into a tin can, reached their ears at, "I do this," and by the time he had spoken the words, "of my own free will," and tossed the walkie-talkie away, its purpose served. A fire rose had bloomed at the base of Flagstaff Mountain. "Breaker, breaker, that's a big 10-4. Over and out," Harold said softly. Nadine clutched at him, much as Franny had clutched Stu only seconds ago. "We ought to be sure. We ought to be sure that it got them." Harold looked at her, then gestured at the blooming rose of destruction below them. "Do you think anything could have lived through that?"
I don't know, Harold.
Nadine turned away, clutched her belly, and began to retch. It was a deep, constant, raw sound. Harold watched her with mild contempt. She turned back at last, panting, pale, wiping at her mouth with a Kleenex, scrubbing at her mouth.
"Now what?"
"Now I guess we go west," Harold said, "unless you plan to go down there and sample the mood of the community." Nadine shuddered. Harold slid off the picnic table and winced at the pins and needles as his feet struck the ground. They had gone to sleep.
"Harold!"
She tried to touch him, and he jerked away. Without looking at her, he began to strike the tent.
"I thought we'd wait until tomorrow," she began timidly.
"Sure," he jeered at her. "So 20 or 30 of them can decide to fan out on their bikes and catch us. Did you ever see what they did to Mussolini?" She winced. Harold was rolling the tent up and cinching the ground cords tight. "And we don't touch each other. That's over. It got Flag what he wanted. We wasted their free zone committee. They're washed up. They may get the power on, but as a functioning group, they're washed up. He'll give me a woman who makes you look like a potato sack, Nadine. And you, you get him. Happy days, right? Only if I were wearing your hush puppies, I would be shaking in them plenty."
"Harold, please."
She was sick, crying. He could see her face in the dim fire glow and felt pity for her. He forced it out of his heart like an unwelcome drunk who has tried to enter a cozy little suburban tavern where everybody knows everybody else. The irrevocable fact of murder was in her heart forever. That fact shone sickly in her eyes. But so what? It was in his as well, in it and on it, weighing it down like stones. "Get used to it," Harold said brutally. He flung the tent on the back of his cycle and began to tie it down. "It's over for them down there, and it's over for us, and it's over for everybody that died in the plague. God went off on a celestial fishing trip, and he's going to be gone a long time. It's totally dark. The dark man's in the driver's seat now. Him. So get used to it." She made a squeaking, moaning noise in her throat. "Come on, Nadine. This stopped being a beauty contest 2 minutes ago. Help me get this shit packed up. I want to do 100 miles before sunup." After a moment, she turned her back on the destruction below, destruction that seemed almost inconsequential from this height, and helped him pack the rest of the camping gear in his saddlebags and her wire carrier. 15 minutes later, they had left the fire rose behind and were riding through the cool and windy dark, heading west. For Fran Goldsmith, that day's ending was painless and simple. She felt a warm push of air at her back, and suddenly she was flung through the night. She had been knocked out of her sandals.
"What fuck?"
she thought. She landed on her shoulder, landed hard, but there was still no pain. She was in the ravine that ran north to south at the foot of Ralph's backyard. A chair landed in front of her, neatly, on its legs. Its seat cushion was a smoldering black snarl.
"Well, fuck!"
Something landed on the seat of the chair and rolled off, something that was dripping. With faint and clinical horror, she saw that it was an arm.
"Stu?
Stu, what's happening?" A steady, grinding roar of sound engulfed her, and stuff began to rain down everywhere. Rocks, hunks of wood, bricks. A glass block spiderwebbed with cracks. Hadn't the bookcase in Ralph's living room been made of those blocks? a motorcycle helmet with a horrible lethal hole punched through the back of it. She could see everything clearly, much too clearly. It had been dark out only a few seconds ago. "Oh, Stu, my God, where are you? What's happening? Nick? Larry?" People were screaming. That grinding roar went on and on.